Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, May 29th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from WCAI's Sam Houghton and Eve Zuckoff. We'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood, the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent and Matt Goisman from the Cape Cod Times. We'll speak with Jack Spillane at the Standard Times, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette, and we'll hear from Mike Dean up at the State House. WCAI Sam Houghton leads us off right now with an overview of the latest numbers and information on the local coronavirus response. Hi, Sam. Sam, this was a week. Can you hear me, Sam?
Yeah.
Well, this was a week with mostly lower numbers of new cases of coronavirus across the state, and fewer people have been dying. Tell us what we've been seeing through the numbers.
The number of hospitalizations have been falling, not as rapidly as last week, but they are going down. There are about 2,000 people that are hospitalized with the virus as of yesterday. That's 300 fewer patients than last week. Locally, hospitalizations have remained steady, about 20 patients on the Cape now and over 100 at the three South Coast hospitals. Martha's Vineyard did report a new case yesterday, but still no one is hospitalized there. And Nantucket continued its trend. No new cases for over a week. And then looking at the numbers, nearly 100 new cases over the week on the Cape. That's about 1,300 cases in total. But that also includes people that have recovered. And county officials say that's anywhere from 60 to 70% that have recovered. One sobering milestone on the Cape, over 100 people have now died from the virus. And then in Bristol County, between 500 and 600 new cases over the week for a total of 6,800. Plymouth County, about 300 new cases over the week, so that number has slowed a bit. But overall, the numbers are trending down across the state, and Governor Baker says that's because people are taking responsibility.
Now, the Cape Reopening Task Force has been trying to reboot the local summer economy while keeping the community safe. There are members from the Chamber of Commerce, the state legislature, county government. Tell us the latest on how they're trying to help.
Yeah, they spoke to reporters after Memorial Day weekend. All expectations heading into the weekend was that it would be a slow start to the summer, and it was. I think the word that's been thrown around is subtle. But now they're focused on helping businesses survive over the summer by letting visitors and residents know what's open, what protocol is around beaches and other areas. They announced a new website where they have information for visitors and residents and also for businesses and town hall officials. That's reopeningcapecod.org if you want to check that out. They also announced that they would offer towns free signs for beaches with these new guidelines. That's like keeping 12 feet of distance between groups on the sand and wearing a mask when you can't socially distance. The task force has been encouraging each town to adopt a uniform rule. They're saying without uniform rules, you might have one town with more relaxed rules and their beaches might get bombarded with visitors.
Hey, Sam, you also talked with the health agent in Sandwich who has a concern about college students returning to the Cape and potentially bringing the virus with them.
Yeah, Dave Mason is the health agent there, and he told me that some college students are now returning home. They likely had apartments near school for remote learning. And some returning to Sandwich have actually tested positive. Mason says they are self-isolating, and the town is checking in on them daily, making sure they have everything they need and that they're okay. But his main point, which you hear from a lot of officials, all the way up to the governor, is personal responsibility. If you've been hanging out with friends at college, socially distance when you get home, wear a mask, stay 6 feet, be responsible. I think it's a tough time for everyone, but college kids might feel the need to hang out with friends, and they might feel immune to the disease. But as most of us know, they could pass the virus to others unknowingly that might not be resistant, and that's a concern in Sandwich and probably the rest of the Cape.
That is WCAI Sam Houghton. Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Memorial Day weekend kicks off the unofficial start of summer on the Cape and Islands, which normally means thousands flooding to second homes and beaches. But as we just heard, this year the coronavirus upended the typical busyness. WCAI's Eve Zuckoff joins us now to talk more about the holiday weekend and how it looked to businesses and tourists and year-rounders. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Eve, on Memorial Day weekend, you rode the ferry to Martha's Vineyard. You checked out a number of spots on the island. How much quieter was the island this year compared to past years?
It was slow. It was really, really quiet. And I think the best way to kind of explain how much quieter is just by the passenger traffic on the ferry. So between Thursday to Monday of the holiday weekend, ferry traffic was down 65% this year compared to last Memorial Day weekend. It's about 30,000 fewer people on the island, at least by ferry, not including those who fly over. And actually on Nantucket, it was even more extreme, down about 72% this year compared to a year ago. And just honestly walking around for hours during the day from Oak Bluffs to Vineyard Haven, the streets were just pretty empty. I mean, it felt like a weekend in January.
What did you hear from business owners and from visitors about how this slow pace maybe affected them?
Yeah, well, one business owner told me that business was down about 70% from last year's Memorial Day. And at a car rental place, I was told usually on Memorial Day weekend, you can rent about 50 cars in a day. This year, it was 3 or 4 cars in a day. And, you know, things aren't that easy for day trippers either. I mean, they're escaping, you know, yet another day of gardening in their yards, but they came to the island and they couldn't find bathrooms, a lot of them. And it didn't help that the weather this weekend wasn't great, but overall it was a sense of just anxiety. These businesses rely on tourism. And this was a 3-day weekend. The next few weekends will probably be even quieter, it stands to reason.
Eve, the virus has upended so much locally. You also reported this week that fears about it led Barnstable County officials to end the Cape Cod AmeriCorps program early this year. Tell us what happened and what it's meant for service members.
Yeah, that's right. So basically, Barnstable County officials told the 20 Corps members across the region who live in kind of 3 houses and serve that their service year, which was scheduled to end in late July, would instead end almost 2 months early, and their housing would be taken away in 2 weeks' time. And so now these mostly young people who have been making $8,000 a year have to fly across the country, go through major airports. Others, you know, afraid of you know, contracting coronavirus while traveling are saying, okay, we're going to drive 24 hours cross country. Others don't really have a great sense of where they're going to find housing. They'll sleep at a friend's house for a few months, but they've just really described feeling like this was a complete shock. They told me they felt like the rug was pulled out from under them. And it's just one of these stories where we come to understand, you know, how integrated housing and work and healthcare and safety really are in a time of pandemic.
So these service members are people who do things like trail maintenance and shellfish monitoring and emergency management planning in all 15 towns across the Cape. Now that they're being sent home, is there reason to think that there won't be a next class of AmeriCorps service members?
Well, no, actually. Earlier in May, the Massachusetts congressional delegation announced it would provide more than $500,000 for the next class of AmeriCorps members on Cape Cod. The county has said that they've loved working with these service-oriented people for the last 21 years and expects to welcome the next class in September, but we will see.
That is WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
A vision is shaping up for replacing Martha's Vineyard's Windermere Nursing Home, and it breaks the established mold. George Brennan joins us from the Martha's Vineyard Times to explain. Hi, George.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
George, the idea for what to do as a replacement for Windermere Nursing Home, this is not like most people would think of elder care residences, what they're proposing.
No, this is sort of like cluster housing where there are individual homes. And, you know, so it gives the senior citizens a chance to live in a setting that they're more accustomed to, and also get the nursing and skilled care that they need from a nursing home at the same time. It's been catching on across the country in various places. As people on the island know, Windermere has been bleeding money now for years and years. And while the new CEO, Denise Schapici, has of Martha's Vineyard Hospital, has committed to keeping Windermere until a replacement is found, you know, she has said that replacement does need to be found soon. So this presentation by Greenhouse was before Healthy Aging MB, that's a elder services organization on the island, and there was some excitement about this. The hospital has some land for it, and this Navigator program is looking to spend about $34 million on the design and planning stages for construction and to get this open at some point in the not too distant future. There are no definitive plans yet. This is just sort of being introduced across the island. But it creates these neighborhoods, and, you know, certainly most of us like that particular setting to live in a neighborhood with other people and sharing resources. So it's an interesting idea, and a lot of excitement on the island for it.
So just specifically, the model calls for a number of seniors to live together in a house that shares living spaces. Is that right?
That's right. You know, they would have, you know, a kitchen. You know, the person who was on this call talked about how, you know, people still like to cook or bake. And, you know, one person could be baking cookies and distribute them to their neighbors. Just as, you know, we would do in our own neighborhood. So it creates that community feel to it that's so much different than any other assisted living or nursing home settings. So it does sound intriguing. And with the Vineyard's, you know, ever-increasing senior population, there is a need for this type of housing on the island.
Let me ask you about another story you have in the paper this week. Tisbury is considering its options for providing social distancing for town employees in the workspace. And tell us what they're thinking here.
Yeah, this is interesting because Catherine Cornell Theater, as lots of folks know, is a place that's both used by the town for its selectmen meetings and other board meetings, but also for local theater, music groups, student groups. That stuff's all been canceled right now. And so the town is looking for ways to social distance its employees when they start coming back to the office. And one of the ways they've looked at is to put some cubicles up in the theater. And that's not sitting well with at least one selectman who thinks, you know, they ought to be reserving that spot so that when things can open, they can start having gatherings at the Catherine Cornell Theater. But there are people in the town town hall who want to be together in the same building. It's always been a goal of the town to get everybody together. They already have an annex where, you know, several town departments, the building department, the health department, they're off in another building miles away from town hall. So they'd like at some point for them all to be together and not spread out. And so one of the ways to make sure that even more people aren't displaced is to use this particular part of the building. No definitive decision was made, but it just speaks to some of the decisions that are having to be made by towns. We have a lot of town meetings coming up, and, you know, so Oak Bluffs and West Tisbury are both looking to use the Tabernacle, which is in Oak Bluffs and is part of the Methodist camp there,
yeah,
as a venue for town meetings.
A lot of creative thinking going on right now to try to put this together. That's George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. Have a good day.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Steve Junker. The question of what to do about town meeting in the midst of a pandemic has many towns scrambling. Now, Harwich has a plan. Tim Wood joins us from the Cape Cod Chronicle with that story. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, Harwich already delayed spring town meeting once. Now it looks like they'll push it back again much further. Tell us what they're thinking.
Sure. The Board of Selectmen originally voted to move the annual town meeting from the traditional May date to June 22nd. But because of uncertainty over gathering size and really a desire to keep residents safe, Selectmen this week voted to push that date off even further to September 28th. Selectmen authorized interim town administrator Joseph Powers and moderator Michael Ford and town clerk Anita Doucette to take whatever steps were necessary to postpone the meeting until that September date, in the hopes that by then it will be safe to gather and the limit of 10 people, crowds of no more than 10 people will be lifted. Now this of course throws in some complications for the town's operations because, as you know, normally the towns hold town meetings before the July 1st end of the fiscal year and
the budget has to be
budgets.
Set. Yeah.
Exactly. So by setting the meeting for September 28th, that means that a budget for the next fiscal year won't be set when the current fiscal year ends. So Selectmen also authorized Powers to follow state emergency guidelines that were put in place by the governor and develop what is referred to as a 1/12th budget. Now the state essentially is authorizing towns that won't be able to set those budgets by the new fiscal year to spend up to 1/12th of their previous annual budget per month until a new budget is approved. So Powers said he anticipates doing that for July, August, and probably into September. And he also said he anticipates that September 28th meeting will be a full warrant, not an abbreviated meeting. And he said there will likely also have to be a special election in the fall to approve sewer borrowing and a few other debt exclusion items that will be on that warrant.
Tim, another piece of news out of the paper this week. Monomoy High School has a new principal. It's just the second in its history.
Exactly. Earlier last month, Principal William Burkhead, who's the first principal of the school, has been there about 6 years. He announced that he was going to be taking a job as superintendent of schools in Scituate. And this week, superintendent of the Monomoy School, Scott Carpenter, announced that he was appointing the current Monomoy High assistant principal, Jennifer Police, as the school's new principal. She was chosen from a field of about a dozen candidates and was the top choice of a search committee that was working on this. Carpenter said Jen Police has a great connection with students and family and the families in the district, as well as being an educational leader with a keen appreciation of the academic and cultural aspects underlying the Monomoy High School. She's been assistant principal at the school for the past 2 years, focusing on curriculum and instruction, so she really knows the school pretty much inside and out. Before that, she was the director of guidance for 3 years, so she's been with the system pretty much since Monomoy High began 6 years ago, and this, along with her being just the second principal in Monomoy, next fall we'll start the new school year with brand new leadership at both the high school and the middle school. Current middle school principal Mark Wilson is retiring at the end of June, and the current assistant principal there, Adam O'Shea, has been named as the new principal. So we'll get two new principals, both of whom come right from the district. So it should ensure that there'll be some consistency there.
That's Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. Have a great weekend.
At the National Seashore this past week, rangers had to take the unusual step of killing a coyote. From the Provincetown Independent, we're joined now by Ed Miller with that story. Hi, Ed.
Good morning, Steve.
Ed, we hear a lot the admonition not to feed wild animals. And according to park rangers, this appears to be a case of that behavior from humans creating kind of a tragic situation. Is that right?
It is right, Steve. It's there was a series of events leading up to a really scary and sad conclusion over Memorial Day weekend. It really started weeks before that. The seashore had been receiving a number of complaints or reports from people, especially at Herring Cove Beach in Provincetown, that there was at least one coyote that was brazenly following humans and dogs and could not be easily scared off. And, you know, coyotes are usually pretty shy about approaching people. More and more of these reports were happening of coyotes that didn't seem to be scared at all. And on May 15th, the seashore posted signs warning people not to feed the coyotes. But the complaints continued and got more serious. And on Thursday, May 21st, a woman who lives in Provincetown, Karen Capato, was at the beach with her miniature schnauzer, had taken the dog off its leash. And a coyote ran out of the dunes, grabbed the dog, but didn't have a really good hold on it, and it dropped out of its mouth. Capato grabbed it, and a friend who was with her managed to chase the coyote away, but it was very frightening. And then on Saturday, May 23rd, a woman who was sitting on the beach just reading a book was bitten on the ankle or nipped on the ankle by a coyote who approached her.
That's quite remarkable that it would come up and nip her on the ankle, yes.
Yes, and, you know, we don't know what attracted the coyote to her, but probably the story is that if people have been feeding the coyotes, they have become, as it said, habituated. In other words, they have lost their fear of humans, and they see humans as sources of food and will approach them looking for food, and including, I guess, a taste of ankle. So
there was one more incident, too, now where a dog got taken completely, right? And then they decided,
yes,
the seashore has decided that they have to take action.
On Monday, Memorial Day, May 25th, a young couple was playing with their dog at Herring Cove, tossing a ball. A coyote suddenly ran out of the dunes, grabbed the dog, and ran back into the dunes. And some people who were there and saw it tried to chase the coyote but couldn't catch it, and the dog was killed. And as a result of that, the rangers had to take action. They had been marking these coyotes with paintball guns. And so they had been tracking at least one coyote that was habituated in this way. They went and they shot one of the animals. They're pretty sure it was the one that killed the dog, but at the same time, they think that there are probably other animals that have been fed. And it really is a story of, please stop feeding wild animals, as Provincetown Police Chief Jim Golden says. It's a sad case of people who are animal lovers and think that they're doing something good, and in fact what they're doing is creating a situation that's really terrible for people and their pets and the coyotes themselves.
Ed Miller from the Provincetown Independent. Ed, thanks for joining us with that.
You're welcome, Steve. Have a good weekend.
You too. You may still be able to catch a live baseball game on Cape Cod this summer, but it won't be Cape League action. Matt Goisman joins us now from the Cape Cod Times to explain. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for having me on the show.
Matt, these could be American Legion teams that are playing. Is that right? Tell us what's happening here.
So it has to be really, really careful with how I answer that. These are going to be, if this happens, and again, this is still in the planning stages, these would be teams comprised of players who in a previous year perhaps would be playing on American Legion teams. But this year, because it's going to be an independent league, they will not be actual Legion teams. They can't have any American Legion iconography or logos on their uniforms. They can't even use like the post, like Sandwich Post 188. So coaches from Legion teams are organizing it, but it will not be an American Legion season.
So for folks who don't know, there are these American Legion posts across the Cape, right? And they often, in the summer, each field's a baseball team and they play each other. Is that how this typically works?
Yeah, it's a league of, teenage players. There's a junior division and a senior division. The senior division is 16, 17, 18-year-old, et cetera. There's three Legions on Cape Cod. There's one in Barnstable, one in Sandwich, one in Orleans. And then they play in a district, District 10, which includes several other Legions from like southeastern Mass, like Wareham and Bridgewater, et cetera. And normally they would play a regular season, then a district playoffs, then state, regional, conceivably the national tournament if you go that far. Obviously, all of that has been called off by the American Legion national organization, due to coronavirus.
So the folks who would normally be involved in this are trying to sort of to organize this as an independent league, but it's not officially an American Legion baseball initiative here. And that has to do with the fact that the American Legion organization has called off its season. But can it be done safely? I guess that's a big question, right?
Well, they're certainly trying to put a plan in place that they think will keep players safe, and then it's up to the various towns whether or not they think it's a feasible plan or not. They want to create something that can be done safely where, they've talked about making sure they're taking every player's temperature, probably in, like, the parking lot, so that if they do have to send a kid home, they can do so without the kid first conceivably exposing other players. There might be differences in how the dugouts are set up, so everyone is spaced farther apart, or maybe they won't even use the dugouts. Perhaps they will just space out like 10 feet apart along the foul line. There's all kinds of things they're trying or they're considering that will keep kids safe.
And how will the teams be identified if they're not identified by their posts?
So that's still to be determined. They may use just their town names like Sandwich or Barnstable. I spoke with the Barnstable general manager, David Murphy, who has run independent leagues in the past. He talked about using possibly one of the team names or logos from a team he's already had, an independent team he's already had. The example he gave was called the Centerville Coyotes. Normally, Legion teams don't have mascots like that, so maybe teams will have names much more similar to what you'd see at the high school level, the varsity level, or, a pro team like Boston Red Sox, something like that. But that's all still to be determined.
Just to hear a bat hitting a ball or even an umpire calling a strike would be a lovely thing this summer, as long as it's done safely. Matt Goisman from the Cape Cod Times, thanks for joining us with a story.
No problem. Have a good weekend.
Towns across the region are wondering how they're going to enforce COVID-related beach rules this summer. Nantucket has a plan. Josh Balling joins us now from the Inquirer and Mirror with that story and more from the island. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, tell us what the town has in mind here for enforcement.
At the moment, what the town is hoping to do for enforcement is largely advocacy and relying on personal responsibility for beachgoers this year who will be going to the beaches with the new rules that have been advised, including the ban on groups larger than 10 people, no groups within 12 feet of each other, prohibitions on organized games and activities, face coverings, all of those usual guidelines that everybody seems to be dealing with these days. Nantucket also has a long tradition of beach driving, and cars must be separated now by at least 15 feet, which is not what they usually do. Implementation and enforcement, it comes down to the responsibility of the individual cities and towns. And Nantucket's town manager and some town officials are saying that they hope that, enforcement can be done through advocacy, that that people will do the right thing. It will be tough to enforce. Nantucket has miles and miles of both public and private beaches. Many of those private beaches are open to the public by agreement with property owners. There's also miles and miles of beaches owned by conservation groups that are definitely open to the public. The land bank, which owns about 5 miles of those beaches, is taking a similar approach to the town. They don't have any plans to close any of their parking lots or their beaches, but they also say that they don't have anywhere near enough staff to continually monitor if people are social distancing or if there are too many cars in a parking lot or on a beach. Town officials are at the same time, however, working on recommendations to give to the select board in the event that advocacy and personal responsibility don't work, and come up with some guidelines on how to educate people on best practices and maybe come up with some enforcement. They're also trying to determine what a vehicle capacity could be on a beach where vehicles are allowed. One of the things early on that at least one select board member is saying is that Nantucket, because of its abundance of riches of beaches, maybe people could start simply by trying to visit some of the smaller beaches that they don't typically go to. They could stay away from Surfside or Jetties Beach, Matt Fee says, and maybe try an area that's less crowded, one of the conservation property beaches or some of the other beaches, public beaches that are a little bit less off the beaten path this year in this social distancing summer.
Let me ask you about Nantucket High School. The graduation is going virtual this year. It sounds like there's a lot of work behind making that happen, but not everyone is happy about this decision.
True on all accounts. There was definitely a lot of work that went into this among some of the school administration and the senior class, and there appears also to be a little bit of backlash, maybe more than a little bit of backlash, from parents and some students who are hoping to have some kind of an outdoor ceremony that could be attended by more people later in the summer. But the decision was made this week by Principal John Buckey and the senior class officers, with input from a committee of students and the class advisor, to do a virtual graduation ceremony, to basically have it happen in three parts. Students will be assigned to come to the school on June 8th or 9th in smaller groups, where they'll put on their cap and gown, have their pictures taken, and walk across the auditorium stage to receive their diploma from the principal. The public access television station here on the island, NCTV, will film all of them receiving their diplomas. Four family members will also be allowed to be in the auditorium for each student while they cross the stage. And after every student is filmed, the valedictorian, salutatorian, class officer speeches, and school official speeches will also be filmed, and that will all be packaged together and shown on NCTV on June 13th. That's a Saturday, the day that graduation was originally supposed to have happened, for everyone to see. Those opposed to the idea, though, said that they don't believe that enough options were explored, that there could be some outside options that might be a possibility, and they don't understand why it couldn't wait until late July, when state guidelines will likely allow for outdoor graduations. Those in support of doing it virtually, though, said, there's no guarantee that anything's going to happen or will be allowed to happen by then. And some students may have already moved on to the military or to work or to early college programs. And it made more sense for them, the students in particular, that it happened now, even if it's just virtually, to allow the graduation tradition for all the students to continue.
Josh, real briefly, Nantucket is considering outdoor dining and maybe drinking, like many towns, to help restaurants survive stricter regulation this summer. What's some of the thinking there?
Some of the thinking is definitely exactly that, to give the restaurants a fighting chance to make some money in the short season out here this summer. And given the capacity regulations that everyone is expecting to come down from the state in terms of social distancing and the number of occupants allowed inside a building or a restaurant, that they might allow them to put tables outside where they normally wouldn't, and perhaps also allow alcohol service outside, particularly for those restaurants that have the ability to, but also downtown in particular, to close off some sidewalks, potentially even close off some streets, maybe on a rotating basis, to allow restaurants to set tables outside, to serve alcohol outside. That would also require a change in the rules from the state at this point to do that. But in particular, just basically to allow the restaurants to get a few more people in the seats, a few more diners in their establishments, to keep people employed and to give them a fighting chance in a season that really only at this point is probably going to last about 8 or 9 weeks.
It's Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. A waterfront entertainment and dining complex will not open this summer in New Bedford, as had been previously planned. Jack Spillane of the Standard Times brings us the story. Jack, how are you?
Pretty good. How are you today, Steve?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. Jack, this was to be called, or it is to be called, Cisco New Bedford when it eventually opens. Tell us what was planned here and what's going to happen now.
Well, it's sort of patented after Cisco Nantucket. And in fact, the Cisco Nantucket owner is one of the partners in this project. It was supposed to be a big $2 million entertainment restaurant complex, sort of a Jimmy Buffett type place where you combine beach volleyball with cocktails and bands and the whole shebang. They had hoped to open in May and were busy building in March when everything was called off. They say that it's not going to be a total loss, even if they delay the project for an entire year, which they've decided to do because of the very low interest rates that people are getting now when they do construction. But it was really the biggest project in New Bedford this summer, and so I think some people were disappointed, although if you had walked by the construction site the last few months, you could tell that they weren't doing much.
How far along did they get in terms of employment? Were people counting on this for jobs?
Yes, they had hired some people, including a general manager, but in the end, because they were early enough, most people, like I think there was just one person whom they didn't name who was not able to get another job. Some people went back to their previous jobs. So it was not a total catastrophe from that standpoint.
As a proposition, though, the idea is that this is going to go forward. It's going to be delayed at least one more year is the idea. But the people behind it still feel like this is what they intend to do.
Yeah, they don't feel the project is endangered at all, Steve. You don't really get big entertainment restaurant-type projects. New Bedford's beaches are limited, and so you don't get that big kind of project that often. But Steve Silverstein, the developer, who has done a very successful restaurant in downtown New Bedford called the Black Whale, does not seem deterred that this is not still doable at all. There's no talk about, well, maybe we won't finish. They just were not able to proceed with construction at the rate that they needed to with the shutdown to open this year.
It's I'm sure emblematic of a lot of projects that are just stalled right now or hanging fire until some more some clearer idea of what the future looks like it takes shape.
Yes, and of course, entertainment type venues that get a large crowds are the last phase of Governor Baker's four-phased opening up again. So that would not come till mid to the end of the summer at the earliest. And so they were going to lose the season. There was some talk about them trying to build over the summer and opening for Oktoberfest, but they even decided that was a challenge. So next spring is their new date.
That's Jack Spillane at the Standard Times in New Bedford. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
Edgartown has perhaps given more consideration than almost anywhere else in the region to how to bring its restaurant life outside this summer in response to the pandemic. Noah Asimo is with us from the Vineyard Gazette to tell us some about the process they've been through in Edgartown and what they're thinking now. Hi, Noah.
Hey, Steve.
Noah, there were at least four different proposals the town has been looking at for how to make this work. Is that right?
Yes. And they all sort of range from a least restrictive proposal to one that would pretty much shut down most of Main Street. And these have been brought up multiple times at meetings in the town. And I think the gist is basically, because a lot of, towns across the street are fearing that, social distancing protocols looks like those are going to be in place for a while. How are restaurants going to be able to function? And how kind of, especially in summer communities, is business going to be able to be saved? A lot of them are still struggling with takeout and don't really see it as a viable option moving forward. So, yeah, these these are, you know, this Edgartown's calling it the European model, which I think is kind of funny. But basically the plan
it's aspirational.
Yeah, go ahead.
The European model. It's aspirational. It's a nice branding.
Yes, totally. And Edgartown itself, you know, I think that the streets are really narrow. There are some similarities. And I think that, you know, it's an issue that's existed for a while, which is, you know, how do you deal with traffic and congestion in downtown Edgartown? And this is sort of like a peripheral solution to it that, you know, is coming out just because of all the other stuff going on. And just to give sort of a sense for what the iterations of the plan are, like for instance, a sort of less restrictive version would create what they're calling parklets or contiguous zones around certain restaurant groups that would, you know, be shut down to traffic. Restaurants could put their tables outside there, and that would kind of be that. But then even more restrictive ones are sort of shutting down an entire street, and you know, they're shying away from calling it anything like New Orleans. But as far as I can understand it, that is sort of the essence of the plan, which is kind of fun and interesting.
Yeah, kind of fun and interesting, maybe. What are some of the concerns around that? I imagine some people would be like, oh, wait a minute.
Yes, well, I mean, there hasn't been a public hearing on it officially, but a few concerns were brought up at the last meeting. One of them was sort of restaurants that are still open right now. They rely entirely on takeout, and it's unclear how long that's going to be the case and how much their business is going to have to actually adapt to being a takeout business. And if all the streets are shut down, how are cars going to drive up and be able to just get food curbside? The other one is sort of a safety concern with, you know, if all the streets are shut down, how are you going to get EMS and fire access? In there. And I think, you know, these are legitimate concerns. Also, you know, the other kind of flip side of the coin is that traffic is always difficult in Edgartown. Shutting down more streets and parking spaces and that kind of stuff might just make it even more of a problem. But I think sort of the idea is that there's going to be a different crowd probably coming this summer. There's no real way to predict what it's going to be like, but this would at least, you know, offer sort of a solution from a business standpoint to restaurants and for people who might want to actually go out and eat out when they're here.
I guess one thing to keep in mind also in the middle of all of that is that this isn't a solution that's going to make the summer a success in the way that it would be any other year, even with all these things in place.
No.
This is kind of just like a Band-Aid to try to get through what looks like it's going to be a very hard time for businesses.
Right, that's totally true. And one of the business owners actually brought that up at the meeting. He said, you know, if we do this, great, we'll try and take advantage of it, but it's still not going to save our summer. I mean, the other sort of thing about this is that there are issues with sort of the food supply in the town to begin with. There's only one grocery store. It gets totally crowded during the summer months, regardless of whether restaurants are open. So they're hoping that this also can sort of alleviate some food supply, food chain issues, which, you know, I think if restaurants are more open and people are more willing to go and feel safer doing so and there's more opportunity, then I think that's a totally reasonable, I guess, answer to that.
That's Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
The leaders of both the state House and Senate supported requiring nursing homes and other long-term care facilities to report more data to the state health department. But the two chambers struggled to come up with a bill they both agree with, delaying passage of a new law for weeks. Just yesterday, they came to a consensus, and now a bill forcing the State Department of Public Health to issue more data on cases and deaths at nursing homes and long-term care facilities sits on Governor Baker's desk. WCAI's Catherine Iden talked with State House reporter Mike Dean about this and the status of the state's budget for the upcoming fiscal year.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
What have lawmakers been trying to accomplish? They're looking for more data from nursing homes to be publicly released?
So it's not only publicly releasing the data that the state gets from nursing homes, it's how they get that data on a daily basis, kind of the lines of communication between all these different facilities and different state agencies that can then be made public. You know, the basic goal here is to get not only nursing homes, but long-term care facilities, any kind of a facility like that that is dealing with residents or caretaking for people in that 65-plus danger zone with the virus. The House and Senate have taken very different tracks to get there.
What is the House looking for specifically?
The House plan would make DPH report daily on the exact number of cases at nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and all those other kind of long-term care facilities, and make those be reported publicly at a more granular level than what DPH is putting out now on a daily basis. I spoke with Representative Ruth Balzer, who's the chair of the Elders Affairs Committee in the House, and she says it's important to kind of make a uniform, and standard publicly consumable information from DPH so that the public and for lawmakers, policymakers, local boards of health can see where hotspots are, can see, you know, where staff may be infected versus residents. That's an important metric that they want to follow, really just to get as much information out there as possible.
Normally at this time, lawmakers would be heading into conference committee to wrangle some of the details about the upcoming budget for the fiscal year that's right around the corner. Where does the budget process stand now?
The budget's always kind of written by a handful of members and their staff through the Ways and Means Committee, through the Speaker's Office, since the House kind of starts first and then it goes to the Senate. But they essentially had to start from scratch because of the tax revenue that's coming into the state is not nearly as much as they expected. And they don't know when those revenue numbers are going to recover. So we're going to see a far more modest budget coming out of the House that's trying to take in all of these factors and plan for the future when the future is incredibly uncertain right now. So they have, the House gave themselves until the end of July, which is about a month and a half later than they usually do it, to get a bill over to the Senate. And then the Senate process will start up from there. And then maybe we'll get a budget to the governor's desk around August. So they're looking at 1 month budgets, temporary budgets to put in place before an annual one can be delivered because it's going to be so delayed, which actually isn't anything new because Beacon Hill ends up doing that most of the time anyway because they don't ever really get the budget done on time.
What about education funding? There was a big bill that was passed last fall to add more money and change around the education funding formula to make it a little bit more equitable. Is that something that would be rolled into this year's budget, or is that a separate thing?
It would be in the budget. That's on an annual basis. The districts are funded via this formula that, as you said, got rewritten and overhauled last year to the tune of $1.5 billion over 7 years. The approach to that bill was that there wasn't any set way that the state was going to get their hands on that $1.5 billion. Now there's a budget hole that could be upwards of $9 billion just this coming fiscal year alone. So that commitment to fund school districts is maybe something the state can't afford to implement right now.
And that is WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean. Mike, thanks a lot. Have a nice weekend.
Thank you.
And that was WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean from the State House there. That is our news roundup for today. I want to thank my guests. We spoke with WCAI's Sam Houghton and Eve Zuckoff. We heard from George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent. I spoke with Matt Goisman of the Cape Cod Times and Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We heard from Jack Spillane at the Standard Times in New Bedford and Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. And of course, there was Mike Dean up at the State House speaking with Catherine Ident. A big thanks to Dan Treidel back at the studio, the only man at the studio, the only person at the studio these days in the morning. And thanks to my family for letting me do all the talking in the house this past hour. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.